Welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, bringing the tales and stories of the ancient Celts to your fireside. Special episode number 5, part 2, Samhain 2008. Hello, welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show. I'm Gary.
And I'm Ruth. In this show, we'll have a whopping 4 pieces of music for you, a short story, an excerpt from Ellen Evett Hopman's book, A Druid's Herbal of Sacred Tree Medicine, and some stories of families and ancestors from you guys.
And now for some news and views. I've made a few changes to the website to hopefully make it easier to find things. There are little tags and flashy buttons telling you when something's been updated or is new to the site, like the charity section that we mentioned in the last episode. So pop along to CelticMythPodShow.com and check them out.
We've also been very lucky to have been sent some great fairy and goblin art by the well-known and very talented artist Justin Russell. Watch out for one of Gary's little flashy buttons to appear on our resources section when this new gallery goes live. You'll find out more about Justin's work in our show notes.
Talking of fairy art, do you remember a little while back, episode 16 I think it was, we were talking about the wonderful fairy art of Esther Remington?
Yes, I know where you're going with this.
Well, Esther is working with a superb local fairy musician, Kim Tomsett, to produce the artwork for her new album, Songs from the Ugly Meadow.
That's right, and Kim has kindly allowed us to play a track from the album, which is due out on November the 30th. You can find out more about Kim and her album in the show notes.
So let's listen to Kim Tomsett and I Will Be a Stranger.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kim. A really lovely piece of music.
I like that one. Now it's time for a short story by Deborah F. Kemp from the first book in her House of Pendragon series, Firebrand. Let's go back to the fortress of Queen Morgause of Orkney in around the year 500 CE, where we'll meet Lynn and Dovith in a slave hovel. She's about 10 and he's 12, and it's early morning in the slave hovel.
From Firebrand by Deborah F. Kemp. What did you dream of, Lynn? That was our ritual every morning, trading dreams. Every morning that I could remember. Whatever my brother's dream had been, I would carry it through the dreariness of the dozens of mindless chores I would have to do. Davith's dreams made the work a little easier, more tolerable, the blows endurable. I never believed my dreams to be worth much, especially to Davith. But he always asked first.
Some place warm, where it's summer all the time, and I do not need a blanket.
He grinned and said,
Sorry, Lynn.
Then after the briefest pause, he continued on in an excited rush.
But there is such a place. It's called the Summer Country, ever so far from this dreary place in ancient Logres. That's the old name for Britain.
He added with authority.
The Pendragon lives there with his beautiful queen, Gwenivar. The Round Table is there as well.
Camelot?
Camelot.
He answered. My brother's wealth of knowledge amazed me.
What was your dream, Davith?
I never learned it because a commotion arose not far from where we sat and interrupted him in mid-thought. I remembered the current phase of the moon with the familiar sinking of my stomach. Time for collarings. A collar, an insipid thing really, harmless to look at on its own, made of stiff leather, about the width of two thumb breadths, and long enough to wrap round a neck snugly. Our coming-of-age gift from the Queen. It served as a constant reminder of our place, as if the incessant verbal taunts and jeers of everyone in the dun were insufficient to keep us informed of our lonely lot in life. Yet, on that summer morning, I was still innocent, and believed it could never happen to me, or anyone I knew or cared about. Casually I glanced towards the source of the noise. When my stomach stopped its wild descent, it formed itself into a tight knot.
Davith,
I whispered.
Meg is getting...
I turned to see my brother's face had gone ashen. His blue-grey eyes had lost their lustre, and his jaw hung slack. He knew. We both knew what was coming. In the next instant, the overseer jerked Davith to his feet.
Your turn, boy.
What gave them the right? I could not allow it, not to my brother. I had to help him.
No!
I shouted, rushing forward. I swung at the man who would dare violate my beloved Davith with the obscene strip of brown leather. The overseer swept me away with one heavily muscled arm. The blow sent me sprawling. As though on a quest, I sprang to my feet again, screaming the gods know what. Before I reached the overseer a second time, his assistant caught me by the hair, yanked me back and held me fast. I watched helplessly. My brother blinked once, otherwise he did not move. How could he be so silent? How could he accept that thing so peacefully, like a lamb with no idea it's about to be slaughtered? The appalling scene ended swiftly, and the overseer turned to me.
So, you'd protect your brother from his fate, hmm?
The man holding me by the hair snickered. My defiance dissolved as the overseer towered over my head. Eye level with his waist, I got a close-up view of his badge of office, the whip dangling from his belt. He did not reach for it. Instead, he nodded to his aide behind me, who unloosened my hair. The burning across my back came from nowhere a moment later. The force of the blow sent me flat and winded. Before I could catch my breath, a second stroke landed between my shoulders. I was still gasping for air when a fist gripped my hair again and hauled me to my feet.
"You, I'll be watching,"
the overseer said, then released me. My wobbly legs collapsed immediately, and I landed on my knees. I heard satisfaction in the overseer's chuckle.
"Entertainment is over. To work!"
He and his aide strode out. Several of our companions filed after. Daffith rushed to my side, followed closely by Meg, both ready to lend me aid.
"Leave me be. I can do this myself. I do not need your help. I do not want it."
My brother dropped his hands at my outburst. Meg backed away. Everyone else stared mutely as I composed myself. The whip had inflicted more than pain. The overseer had achieved humiliation. It smouldered within me. I had to stand up on my own. Or I did not understand what drove me. I just knew that I must. The effort to heave myself to my feet taxed me greatly. Each movement ignited my fresh wounds, and I stumbled as though besotted. No one had moved, although I knew Daffith wanted to. His eyes displayed his thoughts clearly.
"What are you staring at?" I said.
That infused some life into the crowd, and more people shuffled out. Our duties awaited, and who would risk a beating for me? The heartless one who had not wept for her mother's passing.
"Lynn?"
"We have to go, Daffith,"
I said, and walked away. The day was impossible, having to carry on as if nothing had happened. But something dreadful had occurred to my brother and me. Daffith's collar ground the reality of our condition into me. Until that morning, we had simply been children who worked long and grueling hours for the comfort of others, and reaping none of the benefits of our sweat. Now the world would know at a glance what Daffith was. Not who, but what.
Well, I want to know what happens to Lynn and Daffith. I'm guessing I might have figured out who the firebrand of the title is, though.
Very probably. I can't wait to read the rest of the story.
Sounds good.
And Deborah has a sequel to the book called The Recruit, and I think she's working on a third. Good luck, Deborah. Keep writing. Now let's follow this with some fairy music from deep in the heart of Cornwall. Fairy Feeling by Karen Kay of Fae Magazine.
Cross and see your face through the trees. Through the trees I see your face. I run to you and we embrace the fate of time. The fairy feeling has its charms with me. Small hand reaches.
Beautiful. Really evocative. Thank you, Karen. You can find out more about Karen and Faye magazine in our show notes at CelticMythPodShow.com.
In our search to understand Celtic myth, it's always really good to hear from experts in the field, whether they be academics or modern druids. We're overjoyed that a modern druid from the Order of the White Oak, Ellen Evett Hopman, has sent us a book to read from.
Ellen Evett Hopman is a master herbalist, lay homeopath and counsellor. She was vice president of the Henge of Celtria, an international druid fellowship, for 9 years. Ellen is a founding member of the Order of the White Oak, or Na Dearadh Gila, hope I've said that right, a bard of the Gorsedd of Caer Ibiri, a druidess of the druid clan of Darna, and has been a member of the Order of Bards, Ovates and Druids, and of ADF.
So with great interest, here's a section from her book, A Druid's Herbal of Sacred Tree Medicine, relating to the Festival of Samhain.
Known as Halloween in modern times, this festival now takes place on October the 31st. However, Old Samhain was once a magical 3-day interval, celebrated November 9th to the 11th. This holy day was called Oichashana, Oichanaspridana, or Seanan in Irish, Samhain in Scots Gaelic, Halloween in English, Calangev in Welsh, Calangwaf in Cornish, and Calagoanv in Breton. God, I hope I've got all those pronunciations right.
The first day of winter. For the ancient Celts, the approach of Samhain meant completing the business of the agricultural year in preparation for the onset of winter. Crops of all kinds had to be safely stored and cattle and sheep brought in from the hillsides to be quartered in the barn. Winter wheat had to be ground into flour by this date. Turf and woods for winter fires had to be secured. Debts had to be recompensed. Workers given their wages. Rents paid. Fairs and markets were held and communal gatherings where all contracts were settled. Traditionally, from Samhain to Beltane, stories were told at night around the hearth or fire. It was considered most unlucky to tell stories in the summer, unless there was a very special reason, such as a wedding, an elopement, a battle, or a preparation for a voyage, because that was the season of outdoor activity. The Fianna, roving bands of free warriors with no allegiance to tribe or kin, were supported by the Irish people from Samhain to Beltane. In the summer half of the year, the Fianna supported themselves by hunting. In exchange, the Fianna policed the countryside, enforcing justice. When the business of the old year was concluded, it was time to celebrate the 3-day festival called Trinuxitian Samhaini in the Colony calendar of the Gaulish Celts. It was a magical interval that marked the portal between the light half of the year and the dark half, the Celtic New Year. For the Celts, the day began at dusk, and the year began in the dark, as all births begin, within the dark of the womb or the moist dark of the earth. The start of the dark half of the year was a period of chaos and dissolution, breaking ground for the new cycle of growth to come. Tricks were played on unkind and unjust neighbours. Men and women exchanged clothing, a symbolic act in this magical period, showing that powers and perceptions were free to become extraordinary. The poor wandered from door to door, seeking food and goods to help them through the winter. Families gathered to feast and entertain themselves and put out a spirit plate for any dead ancestors that might happen by, It was important to leave a gift of blood for the land as a blessing and to ritually feed its powers. Fortunately, this was not difficult, as pigs, cows, and other livestock that could not be fed and maintained through the long winter were culled before Samhain, their flesh to be salted, dried, smoked, or packed into sausages. Blood was readily available in every farmstead to be offered to the earth and the stones.
The fairies at Samhain. Above all, Samhain was a time of spirits, fairies, ghosts, and ancestors. As at Beltane, the walls between the worlds were at their thinnest, and it was easy for the beloved dead to pass over into the land of the living. It was said that the Tuatha De Danann appeared at Tara each Samhain. In the Eskra Nerai, which introduces the cattle raider Cúli, the oldest vernacular epic in Western literature, it is related that King Ailill and Queen Maeve left two recently executed criminals hanging in a tree until Samhain was safely passed, because it was considered dangerous to touch a dead body when so many spirits were about. There was a grave risk that a man might be abducted by the Tuatha De Danann and forcibly married to a fairy woman. It was said that the fairy mounds were open at Samhain, and that one could see and hear the Sidhe at their feasting and drinking. The Sidhe were the rulers of Samhain and had control over the ghosts and spirits roaming the earth at that time. The Sidhe also controlled the fertility of the crops and the milk yield of the cows. Throughout the year, they were propitiated with food offerings left out at night. At Samhain, offerings were left out for the Sidhe and for the spirits under their control, and for the spirits of the ancestors. At Beltane, the potent spirit night at the opposite side of the year, offerings were left for the Sidhe and the dead as well. In Celtic Brittany, and in other Celtic areas, libations of milk were poured for the ancestral dead, near or on their tombs. The last potato crop and the last of the grain were left out as a gift for the fairies. It was said that on Samhain the fairies placed a blight upon all fruits left in the fields. It was forbidden to eat any unharvested produce after this time. No blackthorn sticks, the traditional wood used to make shillelaghs, could be cut on the 11th of November. Equal-armed wooden crosses, symbolic of the sun, were hung in the thatch, placed on the earth before the door, and hung in the barn to protect the cows. In Scotland, these crosses were most often made of rowan, bound with red thread. Tiny rowan crosses were concealed in people's clothing as a protective charm. In some areas, a cross of elder was used, a pre-Christian magical totem of protection for the wearer. Bread and cakes for the feast were baked or toasted over a fire of rowan. A necklace of rowan berries was worn by Highland women as protection. Great ladies wore a necklace of amber for the same purpose. In the Christian era, holy water was sprinkled on doors and in stables, on babies and young children, as a form of protection. A bit of iron, fairies have a dread of iron, or a dead coal from the hearth were placed in a cradle. Oatmeal and salt were ceremonially rubbed on children's foreheads as a charm against evil. A candle was lit and left burning all night in the window of a room where someone had died. Candles and lanterns were left burning all night beside graves. Turnips were hollowed out and fantastic faces carved into them, and a candle was placed inside in hopes that evil spirits would be frightened away. The spirits of Samhain were often malevolent. The Pooka, Hobgoblin, the Black Pig and the Headless Ghost were frequently seen. The spirits of persons who had been wronged in life were known to haunt their offenders. If a troop of fairies appeared, the best defense was to take some dust from your shoe and throw it at them. This would cause them to surrender any captive humans in their clutches. To prevent abduction by fairies, one would carry a black-handled knife, or place a bit of steel, such as a needle, somewhere in one's clothing. So many fairies and spirits were abroad that anyone throwing out a dish of dirty water had to yell, "Shalchain!" Watch out, so that ghosts and fairies could avoid being splashed.
A time for divination. Samhain was a potent time for fortune-telling and divining the future. Cakes were baked with small tokens hidden inside. The recipients of these small objects would know their fate for the year. A ring foretold marriage, a coin wealth, a button bachelorhood, A thimble, spinsterhood. A wooden chip meant the finder would be beaten by his or her spouse. A religious medal meant the finder was destined to become clergy. Objects were placed under the pillow to produce a dream of one's future mate. A piece of cake, the first spoonful of colcannon, a traditional potato dish, or the last spoonful from supper. Apples, a cabbage head, a spade, or 9 leaves of ivy were placed in a young lady's left stocking and tied with her right garter. Before going to sleep, the young lady would eat salt herring, salty porridge, or a mixture of flour, salt and soot to induce thirst. That night she would dream of handing her future husband a drink of water. Nuts or beans were assigned names and placed in the fire. The one that popped and flew furthest indicated one's future spouse. Samhain was a powerful time for weather divination. The direction of the prevailing wind at midnight foretold the direction of the prevailing winds that winter. The winds had unique qualities. To the 10th century Irish, the north and northeast winds meant battle or sickness. The winds from the east, southeast and south meant abundant fruit, fish and grain. The winds from the southwest, west and northwest meant battle and famine. The wind from the west meant the death of a king. If the moon was clearly visible at midnight, the prevailing weather that winter would be fair. If the moon was clouded over, there would be much rain. If the clouds raced before the moon, they foretold a winter of storms. A stick was placed in the river to see if the water was rising or falling. High water meant winter floods or high prices of crops in the new year.
A time for mischief. In keeping with the atmosphere of chaos, tricks were played on unsuspecting neighbours, probably those who had violated the rules of hospitality. A carriage might be dismantled and parts left on the roof, or an entire vegetable crop spirited away and hidden. Cabbages and turnips were pelted at doors and chimneys blocked to flood the house with smoke. In a more sinister vein, those desiring the aid of evil spirits would crawl through a briar that had rooted at both ends to make their petitions.
Sacred fire and sacred water. Healing wells and pools were thought to be particularly potent at the fire festivals. At Samhain, the petitioner approached the water by circumambulating it 3 times sunwise and then silvering it with coins. As he or she drank the water, a wish or a need was held in mind. Afterward, a small token such as a hairpin was left near the water, or a small strip of cloth might be tied to a branch of a nearby tree. These actions were a way of casting off the troubles to be left behind. Everything had to be done in silence, before sunrise. On no account were these clothes, pins, or other objects to be touched, lest the ill luck they carried be transferred to another person. As with all the fire festivals, bonfires were a central aspect of the celebration. In ancient times, a great central fire was lit by druids at Tolorta near Tara, the burial place of the daughter Morrui the druid. Herself a great sorceress, Tolorta became conflated with the land goddess to whom the fire was dedicated. The fire was made with 9 sacred woods: willow, hazel, alder, birch, rowan, yew, ash, elm, and oak. All household flames were extinguished, and runners carried torches back to the provinces, bearing fresh flames from the goddess's fire. Thus, as at Beltane, the kingdoms and tribes were spiritually united through the medium of sacred fire.
The deities of Samhain. The horned god Cernunnos was said to lead his wild hunt through the skies at Samhain, gathering in wandering spirits to bring them home to the underworld. On the Isle of Lewis, offerings of ale were made to the sea god Shoni in hopes that he would cause rich crops of seaweed to wash onto the shore for use as food and compost for the fields. Throughout Scotland, Nigneivin, daughter of Nemain, an aspect of the Morrigan, was honoured, and the Cailleach in her guise as the harsh land goddess of winter.
Preparing for the feast. Apples and nuts, especially hazelnuts, were sacred foods of the Samhain feast. Hazels were sacred to the goddess because of the milk found in the green nut. Children born in autumn were fed the milk of nuts mixed with honey to strengthen them. Apples were sacred because they grew in Avaloch, Avalon, the Celtic land of the dead. An apple branch or a single apple could magically transport one to the other world. Apples were associated with immortality, possibly because those who ate them remained healthy and lived long lives. Children and youths with their faces painted or wearing masks went door to door asking for apples, nuts, bread, cake, butter, milk, cheese, or eggs, anything to help them make a party. The procession was led by a mysterious figure wrapped in a white sheet and having a mare's head. This figure was known as the White Mare, or Hobby Horse, and may have been a symbol of the land goddess to whom the offerings were due. Games were played that featured apples, such as bobbing for them in a vat of water. The water was first silvered by tossing in a few silver coins, the traditional offering of peace to water and waves. Water is the medium through which the ancestors can be contacted, adding further symbolism to the sport. Another apple game featured a stick tied to the end of a rope with an apple stuck on one end of the stick and a lit candle affixed to the other. As the rope was swung in a circle, the object was to catch the apple in one's teeth. For younger children, a potato was substituted for the lit candle in the interests of safety.
I like the idea of that game.
Yes.
You get all these kids standing around with being hit in the head with apples.
Yes.
Still, great information there. The book really is a mine of information like that. The first part covers the sacred trees associated with the Oum alphabet, oak, hazel, willow, and so on, and the history, herbal, and spiritual aspects of each tree.
The second half of the book gives lots of information about Druid practices, and we're starting to learn a lot. Thank you, Ellen. You can find more about Ellen and her books in our show notes.
Let's have some more music. In the words of the immortal bard, the gods gave us music, and when we play in their sacred places, they listen.
That's Dave the Bard, not Shakespeare, and here's his amazing track, The Cauldron Born.
Sunset, moonrise, and see how the land is bathed in silver hue. You feel so lonely. Come with me and let me show there are others just like you who feel the powers of earth, sea and sky, of dragon and fairy and shades of the night. Hear the call of our ancestors of blood and bone, of womb and tomb and standing stone. Lady, stir your cauldron well, chant your words and sing your spell. Deep within this dark and cold, hear the goddess Ceridwen call. See a man alone on a hill, his arms raised high to the moon. Words, a charm, a spell of power, a witch's rune. He calls to the powers of earth, sea and sky, of dragon and fairy and shades of the night. He calls to his ancestors of blood and bone, of womb and tomb standing stone. Lady, stir your cauldron well, chant your words and sing your spell. Deep within this dark and hall, hear the goddess Ceridwen call. Come and taste of the cauldron's brew, and magic she will give to you. You will dance in the eye of the storm, your Ceridwen's children, the cauldron born.
said when he was just 17. Your future, I'll tell you, every thread and turn, if there to be seen. She took his hands, tracing the lines, searching for patterns and looking for signs. Your life a construction, one day you will see. Through the illusion and into the dream. Lady, stir your cauldron well, chant your words and sing your spell. Deep within this darkened hall, taste of the cauldron's brew and magic she will give to you. You will dance in the eye of the storm, your Ceridwen's children, the cauldron born. So we stand on this hill, our shadows are cast by the moon, chanting words, our charm, our spell of power, our witch's rune. We call to the powers of earth, sea and sky, dragon and fairy and shades of the night. We call to our ancestors of blood and bone, of womb and tomb and standing stone. Lady, stir your cauldron well, chant your words and sing your spell. Deep within this darkened hall, hear the goddess Ceridwen call. Taste of the cauldron's brew and magic she will give to you. You will dance in the eye of the storm, your Ceridwen's children, the cauldron born. Oh lady, stir your cauldron well, chant your words and sing your spell. Deep within this darkened hall, hear the goddess Ceridwen call. Come and taste of the cauldron's brew and magic she will give to you. You will dance in the eye of the storm, your Ceridwen's children, the cauldron born. You're the cauldron born.
Love that track. Now let's go into the poetry corner to listen to The Call of the Morrigan, written and read by our very own Ruthie.
The Call of the Morrigan. Hear the call of the Morrigan, the great mother, the crow of battle, the giver of all life and the bringer of death. I am the goddess that trembles the hearts of men. Receive me not in dread, my daughters, for I dwell within you. Feel my cry in the strife of war. I anoint and guide the weeping dead. I bless the land and bring the harvest. I protect and guide you in your distant lands. I bring the spirits of your ancient kin to stand with you under the cloak of my wings. I am the great healer, ally in your darkest hour. I, the warrior queen that walks by your side. I, the memory of your ancestral home. I am the Morrigan.
The bonds of family are especially strong at this time of year, when the veil between the world begins to thin and the wheel of time slows long enough for us to look back at the lives of our forefathers. To celebrate the season, we've been asking you to send us family stories so that we can share them.
We've had some lovely stories sent to us, and it's our great honour and pleasure to bring these to you and bring you and your ancestors just a little bit closer.
We'll start with a story from Michelle from Buffalo.
I'm the only third generation of my family born in the United States, and due to the recentness of my ancestors' immigration, many stories survive within the family. My favourite is that of my great-grandmother, McNamara. She grew up in the southernmost counties of Ireland, I forget exactly which one, and she was well known for her stubborn and independent personality. When she was approximately 17 years old, her family decided it was time that she was married. An older gentleman, who was most likely in his late 30s or early 40s, expressed an interest in marrying my great-grandmother, and her family began the process of negotiating the marriage. The name of this man has been lost in family lore, but we refer to him as the old farmer down the road. My great-grandmother would have nothing to do with this arranged marriage with a man twice her age, and repeatedly expressed her refusal. Apparently, her parents would not listen to her, and she made a bold decision. In 1921, she travelled by herself to New York City and entered the United States through the now famous Ellis Island, a point of entry for hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of hopeful immigrants from all over the world. Great-grandmother McNamara eventually worked her way across the state of New York to Buffalo, where she happily married and settled to raise her family. Two generations later, I was born in Buffalo, New York, and by all accounts, I've inherited her high spirits.
Thank you, Michelle, for sharing this with us. What an amazing woman she must have been.
She certainly sounds like it, doesn't she?
How strong. Amazing strength of character.
Our old friend Adam has sent us this story.
As the legend goes, Thomas Lynch met Elizabeth Patton in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, USA. Thomas hailed from Cork, Ireland. Elizabeth hailed from Gloucester, England. They had just come over to America in the past week. They moved to, ironically, Gloucester City, New Jersey. Thomas got a job at a lumber mill, and Elizabeth started working at a school. They eventually fell in love and got married. They did have monumental fights often. My great-grandfather said it was the Irish and English in them. They had 10 children, 2 boys, and 8 girls. The girls were raised Protestant, and the boys Catholic. The story goes that they loved each other dearly, but they would go to war every few weeks when the kids would go to friends and neighbours' houses to get away from the arguing. In the end, Thomas passed away at the ripe old age of 82. Elizabeth would say that he should have died earlier. She said he didn't because he was Irish, and that made him too stubborn to die. 1 month later, to the day, Elizabeth did not wake up one morning. She'd written a letter at some point saying goodbye to everyone. She knew she would be gone soon, because she couldn't bear to go on without the love of her life. He died of a broken heart. But the humorous end to this story is that she stated in the letter,
Thomas has gone before me, and I will follow. He was my guardian, friend, and love. But in the end, I win the last argument. I get the last word.
The letter is in a safety deposit box, not in the greatest shape in the world. In the bard's tradition, the story gets passed on to each generation. It probably has changed since even my grandfather has not seen the letter, and it's been a few generations away. So the moral is that even back then, when there were prejudices between the Irish and the English, love had still been found. Also, arguments must be a good thing, having loved each other till the end, and they had no less than 10 children.
Thank you, Adam, for that wonderful story of passion and emotion.
It's great, isn't it?
Super, isn't it?
I just love these old people. They're so strong, so independent.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, we seem to have lost something these days. Our next story comes from Mary Jones, and she tells us a story about the Banshee.
This is a story my aunt told me, I'm working from memory, but then she told it to me secondhand from her mother, my grandmother. My grandmother and her family grew up in coal country in northeastern Pennsylvania. They were coal miners, and they had family on both sides of the Molly Maguires long before she was born. During the 1918 Spanish flu, my mother claims that no one from the town died directly from the outbreak. She attributes this to this cure. Take a bottle of whiskey and keep drinking it until the room began to spin. This actually has some logic to it, since the 1918 flu was the type that triggered a cytokine storm. Essentially, it causes a healthy immune systems to drown healthy lungs in lymph fluid. However, compromised immune systems were not triggered, which explains why young healthy people were more likely to die. By drinking whiskey, my mother's theory goes, people weakened their immune system just enough to keep the cytokine storm from triggering. But people were weakened, and amongst those was my great uncle Michael. He was only about 21, a couple of years after the flu, when he came down sick. I don't know what it was, maybe pneumonia. Here he'd survived the devastating flu that killed so many people at the close of World War I, only to come down with something else a couple of years later. Anyway, he was very sick, and his mother, my great-grandmother, called for a doctor. According to my aunt, a stranger, who she believed to be a doctor, arrived. He was taken up to Michael while everybody waited downstairs in the living room. After a while, he came down and said to the family,
"Someone here is not letting him go. It is time."
And with that, the stranger left. After he left, the family heard a wailing outside, but couldn't find the source. That night, my great-uncle died. My aunt says the wailing was the banshee, but she doesn't know who the doctor was. And that's the end of the story. Anyway, it's a true story, well, at least as far as my aunt believes.
Thank you, Mary. It's amazing how many stories there are like this that seem to bring folklore to life. And they make you wonder, does this come from myth or reality?
Interesting thought.
Isn't it?
And now, a family story from Jason. One of Jason's ancestors is the famous John McNamara, once head of the clan McNamara, who held the nickname Fireball. And Jason has begun to write the story of his ancestors.
The Fireball by Jason McNamara. Duncan stalked silently through the thick underbrush, each step slower than the last. He had heard stories about this man and knew that if he was to pull this off, he would have to tread carefully, literally. The woods were difficult this time of year. In early autumn, most of the Irish oaks begin to shed their leaves, rendering the forest floor a tapestry of red and brown leaves. The sight would usually buoy his spirits, reminding him of his childhood, crushing them under his boots and sweeping them into great piles that he could jump into. But today, he couldn't help but feel differently. He needed to move silently, and these leaves were going to make the effort that much more difficult. Looking up, he could see the mighty oak columns as they perforated the night air. It was a clear night, and the full moon gave out more light than Duncan would have liked. Above the tree line, Duncan could still make out the smoke trail from the camp ahead. He was closing in on his target. Another hour, and then... He'd never killed a man before, or even been in a real fight. Duncan wasn't aggressive by nature, preferring to settle disputes through discussion and inquiry. Usually found that 9 times out of 10 arguments were simply a case of misunderstanding, and effective mediation could easily resolve the matter. However, from what he'd been told about this man, peaceful negotiation wasn't likely to be on the cards. He let his hand slip to the handle of his pistol, nestled in his belt. He'd loaded and primed it before he left. He usually didn't bother loading it, the mere suggestion being enough. But on this occasion, Duncan feared he would actually have to use it.
There's a first time for everything, I guess.
He squeezed tightly and continued negotiating the tangled forest floor. The smoke was thinner now, the fire settling in and beginning to burn clear. This could be a good sign. With the fire dealt with, his target would likely be settling in for the night. Duncan let up a short prayer that the man would be asleep by the time he had crossed the ever-shrinking distance between himself and the campsite. He could begin to see the source of the smoke trail. The crackle of the fire was now distinct. Duncan hoped that its sound might camouflage his footfalls. What was he doing here? Was he really that desperate? After all, Duncan had heard many stories about this man, and none of them inspired confidence in his ability to capture him. Oh, he was tempted to simply turn around and go home. The times had grown hard with the famine, and if his family was going to eat this winter, he would have to find some way of making more money, and fast. He hadn't really considered it seriously when he first saw the bounty poster, but after receiving some inside information from some well-meaning folk in the town, he realised that this may be his one opportunity to secure his family's fortunes, at least for a season. Duncan was close enough to make out the shadowed figure by the fire. He wasn't sure what he had expected. A huge bear of a man with broken teeth and an angry, twisted face, probably. Well, whatever he had expected, this man certainly didn't fit the mold. The man before him was probably around 30 years old, was of average height, with a trim beard, and the beginnings of a nicely shaped beer gut. Duncan watched as the man fossicked around in a brown knapsack, humming gently to himself and drawing out a pipe and a tobacco pouch. Not seeming to have any matches, the figure reached into the fire and drew a still flaming twig with which he lit his pipe, before settling his back against a stone, directly in front of where Duncan was crouched, waiting. This all seemed too easy. There was his target, back to him with a pipe occupying his hands, his pistols clearly resting some distance away next to his knapsack. And yet Duncan held back. Maybe it was from fear. After all the bedtime stories his mother had told him, or perhaps just a morbid curiosity. But Duncan wanted to learn more about this man. He'd heard his name since he was a lad, always spoken in hushed whispers and nervous glances. John McNamara, known as the Fireball, had left the town at only 16, already having a reputation as a brawler and an obvious disdain for the English, and made sail for the French coast. And it was from this point that the stories had really begun to flow. Fireball had apparently reached fame as a duelist, and every week seemed to bring news of some poor Frenchman who had found himself on the wrong side of Fireball's pistols. He was an ordinary man, but for Duncan, this was like hunting a red cap, or any of the other countless fairy creatures his mother had warned him about.
"You're gonna sit in the bushes all night, are you? Or would you care for a bit of tobacco weed?"
Fireball's gruff voice resounded from the other side of the rock. Duncan froze. His hand shot to his pistol.
"Come on then, you daft idiot, before I finish this myself."
Duncan stood, thoughts whirling through his mind. This was the moment he'd prepared himself for. Stepping out from the rock, Duncan levelled his pistol at the man on the other side.
"Fireball, you're under arrest."
"Fireball? Well, that's a name I haven't heard in a few years. French preferred les Irlandais vulgaires, which I think is translated to Irish bum."
He paused, considering.
"I think I prefer a fireball."
"Please, stand and put your hands behind your back,"
stammered Duncan. Ignoring Duncan's less than convincing demand, he carried on.
"No, I only have one pipe, so hope you brought your own. But if you reach into my knapsack over there, you might be able to rustle us up a couple of cups and some very nice whiskey I picked up a few days ago from a lovely couple in Clooney."
"I'm not going to tell you again. Your bounty says dead or alive. And the only reason I haven't killed you so far is because I don't really want to lug your body all the way back to town,"
Duncan replied, hoping he sounded a lot braver than he was feeling. Fireball stopped now, eyeing the young lad with growing impatience.
"You know, if you keep pointing that pistol in my face, it's going to put a damper on our relationship."
Duncan was about to respond when there was a sudden flash of light and he found himself disarmed with a sabre pointing at the nape of his neck.
"Now be a good boy. Grab a seat on that log over there. I haven't killed a fellow Irishman, and I really don't want to start.
The tone was still playful, but it was obvious that Fireball meant business. Duncan looked over at Fireball's pistols, still sitting within easy grabbing distance. But he hadn't even seen the sword flash before he was disarmed, and he didn't like the odds of reaching the guns before the cold steel perforated his throat. He turned back to Fireball, who was still calmly puffing away on his ornate pipe, seemingly with little interest as to whether Duncan lived or died. Taking half a step away from the extended blade, Duncan reached back towards the old tree stump, never taking his eyes off the honed blade. He fumbled briefly as he misjudged the distance and sat awkwardly, one leg barely balanced over the rotting wood.
Now then, you're cozy now.
A smile creeping out from under the carefully manicured moustache. Duncan managed a feeble nod.
Grand,
exclaimed Fireball, returning his sword to the sheath that ran curiously upwards towards his shoulders, as opposed to down the side of his leg. No wonder Duncan had missed the blade.
Now, if you're quite settled, I'd like to have a word with you, Duncan.
If Duncan had managed to keep any of his composure up to this point, now he lost it completely. The Fireball knew his name! The Fireball wasn't just a criminal, not just a wanted man. Every child in the country had grown up being warned of this man. He was more legend than human. Duncan lost count of the number of times his mother had put him to bed, telling him if he didn't settle off to sleep, then the Fireball would come for him. And now, not only was he sitting across from the man, but this living legend somehow knew his name. The shock was enough to knock him off his feet. And with his precarious position on the old tree stump, it did exactly that, landing Duncan squarely in the pile of dry kindling Fireball had set aside some hours ago.
Just relax, will you?
Laughed Fireball between thick dwarfs.
If I wanted to kill you, you'd be dead, you daft idiot. If you'd been listening, you might have noticed I got this fine whiskey in Clooney from a pair of farmers.
Duncan didn't know where this was going and was somewhat preoccupied with pulling the broken branches from his trees.
That would be a pair of farmers named Caitlin and John.
Now Duncan really froze, the discomfort at the branches fading to oblivion. His parents! Fireball had gotten that whiskey from his parents! A deep rage built in Duncan's head, blood pounding in thick, heavy beats like the drums from drill practice. A new strength flowed through his veins as Duncan leapt the 3 meters that separated them. You he erupted as he landed on the surprised Fireball, landing a solid punch to his jaw. But the rage filling Duncan made him sloppy, losing all memory of training, instead letting fly with wild, poorly aimed blows. And it was only the work of seconds for Fireball to pinion Duncan's arms behind the youth's back and force him to the floor. Both men were panting heavily from the exertions.
You daft fool. Your parents are fine. I was going to say that I'm aware of your family's problems, and as a thank you for their hospitality, I decided to help them out.
Shot Fireball between breaths.
But having met their impudent son, I may just have to change my mind about the whole thing.
Duncan struggled against Fireball's weight, still unable to move. Instead, he hissed through his clenched jaw.
You're a fugitive. What do you think you could do about it anyway?
A new thought occurred to him.
We don't want any of your stolen money.
Fireball said nothing, but continued to hold him against the ground. He wondered briefly how this would look to a stranger walking by, two grown men laying atop the other. For the sake of his reputation, he decided it would be best to let the lad up. He waited till Duncan's breath slowed and deepened before lifting the bulk of his weight from the boy.
Well then, I'll promise not to cut you a new one if you'll just settle a moment.
Fireball was beginning to regret using his contacts to organise to meet this troublesome lad, though he couldn't help admire his loyalty and bravery.
Tomorrow morning your parents face eviction if they can't make the necessary taxes on their lands. Am I right?
Duncan grunted in reply, massaging his cheek from where it had been pressed to the ground.
Well, I am planning to represent them in court.
We can only hope that he continues with the story because it's a fascinating tale and we want to know what happens. If you do too, then drop us a line and we'll see that Jason gets your messages. So with all these stories, we couldn't really have a better summary of the Celtic spirits of our ancestors.
That's true. And for all of you thinking about your own ancestors, known and unknown, let's let the amazing Kellyanna bring our reflections to a close with her powerful Ancestors song.
Thank you, Kellyanna. I really love that song. It's wonderful, isn't it?
It is. We're still playing it in the car.
Yep. Now let's have some listener feedback.
Yeah. We've received an email from Brooks, and she says,
"My name is Brooks, and I live in Springdale, Arkansas, US. I'm a Celtic pagan, and I'm of Irish descent. I've been obsessed with Celtic legend and history for years, and I'm currently sitting at work listening to episode 4.
That's what I do. Work and listen to great podcasts. Amazing way to make the time pass, isn't it?
I recently purchased my iPod and immediately set about subscribing to every Celtic or Irish podcast I could find. Yours was the second one I found. But as quickly as I became addicted to my iPod, it became my favourite podcast. I currently don't have much access to the works of ancient Celtic myth and religion, and I find your show very informative and entertaining. Your show not only being entertaining, it's helping with my own spiritual practice. I thank you for the work you do, and I appreciate the attention to detail you pay to those works.
Oh, Brooks, those are some lovely thoughts. Thank you very much. We're so glad you're finding the shows helpful, both at work and in your personal life.
Yes, it really does make us feel like we're doing something worthwhile. Thank you. We'd also like to send a shout-out to Lozboy, who left us our first review on iTunes, at least the iTunes we can see in the UK. Thank you. It's greatly appreciated.
Yes, thank you. It all helps to spread the word. Now, in the spirit of Samhain and all things ancestral, we'd like to play you a promo for another Scott Sigler podcast. I think I've almost heard them all now, and this is the one I'm just finishing off. And like all the rest, it's extremely good. Have a listen to Ancestor by Scott Sigler.
On a remote island in Lake Superior, scientists struggle to solve the problem of xenotransplantation using animal tissue to replace failing human organs. Funded by the biotech firm Janata, Dr. Klaus Ruhmkorff strives to recreate the ancestor of all mammals to genetically engineer a self-sustaining herd of organ donor animals. Ruhmkorff discovers this ancestor, but it's not the docile, harmless creature he envisions. His genius gives birth to a fast-growing evil that nature eradicated 250 million years ago. An evil now on the loose at very very hungry. Scott Sigler's suspense-filled horror thriller Ancestor is the most popular podcast novel of all time. On April 1st, Ancestor claws its way into print. Pick up your copy at Amazon.com or visit ScottSigler.net.
Not one for the kids, that one. And that'll wrap up our holiday special. We're sorry it's been a little longer than usual.
We had so much we wanted to share with you that we just couldn't cut any of it out. We'll keep the specials a bit shorter in future.
Well, we'll try to anyway. You'll hear from us in our next regular episode, which starts the tale of kings, princes of the Shi, a beautiful woman, and two milk pails.
So until next time,
Slongavoil.
Ravencast is a show about customs, rituals and beliefs of our...
Cheers, Pickle.
Could you go and scratch somewhere else, Pat?
I shall go to Dyankecht that he may come and heal. I shall go to Dyankecht... I shall go to Dyankecht. I'm not going to go there.
Here's a small excerpt from a modern book by Marjorie MacArthur about fairly healing.
Fairly healing.
And wailing beings blushed by. Oh, for God's sake. Blushing wailing beings. You can't be doing with them, can you?
You can't.
You've been listening to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, available from CelticMythPodShow.com. We hope you've enjoyed the show and will stay tuned for the next episode. You can send us a quick email or voice feedback by emailing either Gary, that's G-A-R-Y, or Ruth, R-U-T-H, at CelticMythPodShow.com. You can chat to us in the forums on our website. The show notes for this episode can also be found on the website. We'd like to say a special thank you to Kulan's Hounds, who provided us with the theme music for our show. You heard Haghole at the beginning and are listening to The Skylark now. You can find out more about this foot-stomping band at www.sfhounds.com. And thanks again to Diane Arkinstone and Kim Robertson, whose music has been used for some of the incidental music in this podcast. You'll find links to their websites in our show notes.